Hello and welcome. It's Thursday night and you're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Tomorrow, Tim, Butch Witkowski is back. It's been a while since Butch has visited the show.
It has been, yeah.
UFOs, monsters, and strange anomalies, plus a brand new theater of the mind coming your way, and it's a scary one. That takes place tomorrow, so we hope you'll check that out. And remember, this weekend, I'm going to be at Wizard World Minneapolis. I'll be there tomorrow, Friday night. I'll be doing a panel on superhero movies, and I'll be doing a paranormal panel, both of those, one's at like 5 o'clock at night, the other one's at like 8 o'clock at night. Tim will be there for me for the movie panel.
Yep.
I don't know if you'll be hanging around for the paranormal panel, but you'll be around. We had a bunch of listeners ask if we'll be there and willing to sign. We don't have a table, but if you catch us during one of our talks, we'll be happy to sign. Yep. Tim will kiss your babies. Yeah. He'll shake your hands. He'll rub your face against his. Whatever you want.
Sure.
He's all for it.
Yeah.
Wizard World. And then Saturday, I'll be there hosting a Doctor Who fan panel from 3 to 3:45. And then on Sunday, I'm there monkeying around with Peter Tork and Mickey Dolenz, Tim, from the Monkees.
There you go.
They're going to be on hand. There's a great list of guests. You've got characters from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. You've got the Wizard Warlock himself, Charlie Sheen, will be on hand. The Doctor, Peter Capaldi, and Jenna Coleman, companion from Doctor Who, will be on hand as well. A lot of great guests. And the Monkees, Tim. Peter and Mickey together on stage answering your questions. What more could you possibly want? For a list of other fantastic guests and speakers and things that are going to be taking place, check out Wizard World Minneapolis, and you'll find all the information and tickets there. All right, let's get rolling, Tim, with our show this evening. We've kind of talked a little bit about this, and more people have asked for more information regarding the Sorrell Weed House in Savannah, Georgia. And the Ghost Brothers, I think, are actually, remember when we had them on the show, they talked to us about the place, and I think we may have inspired them to go back because they're going in May, Tim.
Really?
To film an episode.
Really?
Yeah, so we wanted to find out a little bit more about the haunted and heinous history of this location. So joining us tonight is Nick Wood. He's a performing artist and storyteller, and he has a passion for drawing guests in using just his voice and a bit of history. He's here with us this evening with his voice and his history, Tim, to talk to us about the haunting of the Sorrell Weed House. Hey, welcome to the show, Nick. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me. Great to be speaking to you, Dave and Tim. Good evening.
Good evening. So the Sorrell Weed House, how long have you worked with them and really kind of researched the history on this place?
Well, myself and the Sorrell Weed House predate my employment here.
Okay.
Let's put it that way. I want to tell you that I'm not a native to Savannah. And
hang up the phone, Tim. I'm just kidding, Nick. We'll keep you. All right.
Not a native of Savannah, but this is home.
Okay.
This is where my son was born. This is home now. And
all right.
This being America's most haunted city was sort of just a bonus when I moved here. But very early on, when I first located to Savannah, Georgia, I had read about the Sorrell Weed House. I had heard stories about the Sorrell Weed House. And I took a ghost tour, just like everybody else does. I took a ghost tour and was absolutely disappointed when my tour didn't take me by the Sorrell Weed House. And later that night, I found myself trying to peek over the walls and through the gates with my camera so that I could just get a glimpse, you know, onto the house. And so to be actually working here today and be sort of the captain of the ship is like a huge, like, privilege. And just it's really, really special. That's the only way I can say it.
Very cool. Yeah, it is a very haunted area. We just talked about that a month or two ago, talking about haunted Savannah, and so active. And I think, again, because of the rich history and the twists and turns our past have, you know, put before us with slavery and the way people acted back then, I mean, that certainly probably accounts for a lot of the weird activity that takes place. But let's start with the history of the Sorrell Weed House. When was this place built?
Okay. All right, Dave, this is a 16,000 square foot Greek Revival mansion that was completed in 1838 for Francis Sorrell, a popular businessman and wealthy shipping merchant. And it was a wedding gift to his second wife, Matilda.
All right. And this, was it originally this stately manor, or was it a smaller home that eventually grew?
No, this was the first house on Madison Square. This was the largest home in the entire neighborhood, and this was a party house. This was truly from 1838 when it was completed right up until the tragedies in March of 1860. This was a party house. This was the party house. If you were anybody in the South, you wanted to be on the Sorrell's guest list. And those parties were known to carry on well into the night. They'd spill out into Madison Square. They'd overflow into the neighbors' homes. This was the place to be in the antebellum South.
Very cool. And the people, talk to me about the people and what were they like? What were their personalities like? Who were they in the town?
Well, Francis Sorrell was, first of all, he was a very respected businessman in the community. He was a deacon of the Presbyterian Church. He was a father of 11 children. He was just a very, very clever businessman. Let's put it that way. He knew his way around the tax laws, and he knew his way around the shipping business. And he had a pretty far reach. Being a shipping merchant, he could always find a better deal just a little bit further up the coast, or he could always find a way to navigate troubled waters and troubled times. But he was also a very sentimental family man. Let's say that. Francis Sorrell, first of all, is born in 1793 in St. Domingo. And today we know that as Haiti. But you have to imagine his father was a French nobleman and a retired army engineer. And at that time was a sugarcane plantation owner. But his mother, and this would be a source of controversy later in times, Francis Sorrell's mother was a Haitian. And she also came from a wealthy plantation family, sugarcane plantation family. And she dies when Francis is really only about 7 weeks old. Now, as tragic as that is, his father goes and abandons Francis when he's only 2 years old, because just prior to Francis's birth, there was an uprising in those islands. And anybody of European descent or fair complexion was getting run out of the islands and slaughtered. So Francis ends up, as a very young child, abandoned by his family, raised by his mother's family, and hidden because of his complexion. He's hidden behind walls and in cellars until he's old enough to be smuggled out of the islands and winds up in Baltimore. But the incredible thing of this entire Francis Sorrell story is that this man is able to, one, sort of deny his mother's heritage and pass as just the son of a French nobleman, receive an education, a life, a job, marries into a wealthy Irish family, inherits some wealth, goes into business, expands. I think I always talk about Francis Sorrell. If the world had really known Francis Sorrell, truly, he would have been no different than the slaves that occupied his property. And what I mean by that is he wouldn't have been able to be educated. He wouldn't have had wealth. He couldn't have been in business or owned property. He was essentially mulatto. He would have been entitled to the same thing as every other mulatto or black slave in the South. So Francis Sorrell's story, his character, his personality, family was very important to Francis. And it shows in his house, in his lifestyle, in his letters. It shows he was a loving man, but he was also a very clever businessman.
And you know, the history of that area prior to them building this home, was there anything about it that made it special or different or weird, that something like a haunting or perhaps darkness would take place there?
Yes. Actually, I'm so glad you asked that. I like to say that Savannah's history is actually far stranger than any fiction that even Jules Verne could write. And the property itself, prior to Francis building a mansion here, is a prime example of this. I'm gonna share a story with you, and this comes straight from the pages of history. And this property, long before the mansion was built, was actually the site of British barracks during the Revolutionary War. In 1778, the colony of Savannah is seized by the British. And they build a great fortification. And that fortification cuts just feet from where the house stands today. But there near a wall, the British had erected officers' quarters and an armory. And that armory and officers' quarters sat on the exact lot that the mansion sits today. Now, where it gets very, very strange, having told you that Francis was abandoned by his father at 2 years old, he never knew his father. He never really knew of his father. He knew very little about him. With that said, in October of 1779, the second bloodiest battle of the American Revolutionary War takes place feet from where the mansion stands today. But those barracks were being bombarded by French cannon fire coming about 400 yards south of here by a very large battalion of all Haitian soldiers who had arrived with the French as reinforcements. Now, here's the twist. The man that was leading the Haitian battalion is Antoine Sorel, who is Francis Sorel's father. And this all takes place 14 years before Francis is even born, 16 years before he'd be abandoned by his father. And his father not only leads this battalion to bombard the property with cannon fire, but they destroy the barracks. They trap about a dozen British officers beneath the rubble. And then some 50 years later, Francis Sorel would be sent to Savannah by the Douglas brothers to open a shipping office. He'd amass wealth. He'd purchase that very property and build his mansion, his shady corner, directly on top of the bodies of those soldiers trapped beneath the rubble that were put there by his father 5 decades earlier. And to think that that is just a coincidence, that is, I mean, that's impressive. That's stranger than fiction.
Okay, so we've got some background on this. We've got some information regarding the players in this story. Talk to me about what was going on. What was Savannah like at that time when he was living in this home and you know, this kind of stately area? I've been there. I mean, it's packed. Was it a larger property at one point?
It was actually. Originally, his shady corner encompassed what would today be 4 lots. And over time, that large property would shrink in size. He sells 2 lots to the west. And then directly on top of his gardens on the west side of the house, he, in 1853, builds a townhome for his eldest children. And this is, again, to his character as being a family man, family being important to him. He has all these children from a first marriage and a second marriage. And the children from the first marriage are getting up there in age, and he wants them to stay close to home. So he builds a townhouse directly on top of his gardens. That becomes part of Shady Corner. They were entertaining. His niece marries to a gentleman named Green, and he builds a mansion just catty corner from Francis's home. And now the families are going back and forth between each other's homes. Parties are going back and forth between each other's homes. So three homes right here on Madison Square are all sort of dominated by the Sorel family, an extended family, and they are a monarchy. They are the patriarch and matriarch of the Sorels, and they're here on one of the newest, most beautiful squares in the city. It's that golden period of the antebellum South prior to the Civil War. So life is really good for the wealthy. And this is a property where their lifestyle is being maintained on slaves. And so there are slave quarters and slave kitchens and working environments. And polite antebellum society is above the dusty streets, and they're above everything else, and they're living the very, very good life.
All right. Now, things start to take a weirder turn and with this family. What was like the dark side of this? And we'll lead into some of the hauntings in the next segment or two, but I'm curious about the tragedies that befell this family.
Yeah. You know, that's sort of something that hovers over us that this property will never truly be able to escape from. Like every prominent family, there is a darker side. And the more sorrowful period of the Sorrell story is really – it comes to terms on March 27th of 1860. I had mentioned that this was a party house, and it was on that date that the Sorrells were due to have a spring event – a large party. Dozens of guests were due to arrive just prior to tragedy striking. Matilda Sorrell, Francis's second wife. Now she is she's just got herself all dolled up for the event. She's made her way down the grand staircase and she's entered into the rear parlor. She's looking for a young Haitian slave that the family calls Molly. Now, a lot of folks, I mean, the story of Molly and Matilda is synonymous with Sorrelweed Mansion, but the origins, the true events that transpired, she's looking for Molly. Molly was Matilda's personal attendant. She would have constantly been right at Matilda's side. She would have delegated responsibilities and tasks to the rest of the slaves on Matilda's behalf. Matilda's looking for Molly and doesn't find her anywhere. Guests are due to arrive any moment. She enters into the rear parlor. She doesn't find Molly. She's upset. And the staff sort of director, well, perhaps, ma'am, she's down in the kitchens. Maybe she's tending to some last minute details down there. And it would never be like Matilda Sorrell to ever make her way down into the working parts of the house. Mm-hmm. But in need of Molly's attention, she actually does. She makes her way down into the kitchens. Down the servant's staircase, still no sign of Molly. And the staff down there, they said, well, perhaps she's out in the drive. Maybe she's tending to some last-minute deliveries before guests arrive. And so Matilda reluctantly makes her way out to the driveway, the courtyard. Still no sign of this young woman, Molly. Now, Molly had been with the family a little less than a year. And being Matilda's personal attendant brought privileges that perhaps the rest of the slaves on the property would not have had. This included having her own private living quarters. She would have had a bed. She would have had her own wash basin. She would have had fine clothing. But Matilda is still not finding Molly anywhere. The last place that she'd imagine Molly would be up above the carriage house, above the stables, in the slave quarters. But that's where she's going to look. And she makes her way up a staircase that would lead directly up to Molly's room, and she can hear Molly inside. She pushes open Molly's door, and she found Molly, but Molly is in the arms of Francis Sorrell.
Oof.
Yes. Now, yeah, I mean, you can imagine she's devastated. This is already a woman who is known as being very emotional. She's suffered long bouts of depression through her entire adult life. She's from a country family, a wealthy family, but she's from the countryside of things. And being in the big city, being someone who has to entertain guests on a regular basis is overwhelming for her. She's constantly just. She's never on the bright side of things, and now she's discovered her husband is having an affair with Molly, which you got to say is really kind of typical, maybe you could say, of slave owners in right. That period of time. But this I mean, there's controversy here. Some would say, based on family letters and things, that this was more of a romance than a master-slave type of thing. I don't want to go into speculation, but let's just say that she discovers this. She's distraught by this. And basically, just before guests are due to arrive for this party, Matilda races back inside the mansion up to her bedroom. Minutes later, she's on the balconies from the third floor of the mansion. She tumbles over the railing. She lands headfirst in the courtyard directly down below. Mm. She lands in what is described in a family letter as, quote, having landed in a crumpled mess. And this being a gossip town, Savannah's always been a gossip town. Being a gossip town, that gossip begins to fly. Needless to say, the party never actually takes place. People are talking about Francis Sorrell threw his wife from the balcony. Mrs. Sorrell, in a fit of lunacy, throws herself from the railing. But it's very interesting. We see a lot of family talk at that time saying that she fainted. And there's some controversy over this today. Some say that Matilda Sorrell simply overwhelmed and distraught, faints, and tumbles over the railing. Others say that she threw herself in, quote, a fit of lunacy. Either way, that was the night that the parties essentially ended. The good times were over, and Matilda Sorrell's story came to a very abrupt end.
And what a horrific ending to this, right? Now, after her death, is there ever any story immediately of her ghost or spirit wandering the courtyard or around that area?
Well, there is, but in folklore. And I've got to emphasize that. Savannah is a city built on folklore and legend. And there is a lot of folks also know the addition to Matilda's story is the fate of Molly, which is approximately 2 weeks later. That young Haitian slave girl that the family called Molly is found hanged inside of her room. And the legend, the folklore that you'll hear echoed through the streets of Savannah today by a lot of Savannah's tour guides is that the vengeful spirit of Matilda Sorrell immediately haunted Molly until she's overtaken with grief and takes her own life by hanging. And that's sort of the conclusion to the Matilda story, but it doesn't stop there because, again, like I said, Dave, this is a gossip town. And the gossip is that, well, Francis Sorrell murders Molly or has her hanged. Or another version of the story is that she didn't hang herself. She was met with foul play either at the hands of one of Francis's many business partners in an effort to conceal any sort of scandal, or worse, Molly was murdered at the hands of one of Francis's very own sons, an act of revenge. And diving into the family archives, one could begin to suspect that there may be some validity to the latter, that there is a slight possibility that it in fact was something carried out by one of Francis's own sons.
Yeah, what a twisted little story of murder and death or alleged murder, suicide, death, all of that going on. Once he's got this second death on his hands, what happens to the family and the people?
Well, I mean, this is just prior to getting into the Civil War. In 1859, just prior to Matilda's tragedy, Francis Sorrell had actually sold the property to one of his business partners, Henry Davis Weed. Now, the reason for this is that Francis is nearing retirement and he's building an office building on Bay Street. The intention is that he and Matilda, once the office building is completed, will retire from Savannah to the Douglas and Moxley estates in Virginia. Francis has already inherited one-fifth of the Moxley dowry through his first wife. His second wife has property on the family estate there in Virginia. And that's where they're going to retire to. And they're sort of just biding their time here in Savannah until the construction is completed. And then they're out of here. But in the meantime, the mansion has been sold to Henry Davis Weed. The Sorrells maintain a residence there. But upon Matilda's death and the death of Molly, Francis, who's now lost his second, his second wife from the same family, is not about to retire to the Moxley and Douglas estates in Virginia. Maybe perhaps he saw that as bad form, but also maybe too many memories. So he has his townhouse directly next door, 12 West Harris Street. That's where the older children are living. He actually moves the older children out of the townhouse into Shady Corner, and he retires himself to the townhouse directly next door. He spends the duration of the Civil War there inside the townhouse. His children are coming and going through Shady Corner, through the Sorrell Mansion. And then towards the end of the Civil War, the Sorrells formally vacate 6 West Harris, and Henry Davis Weed gives the mansion to his daughter, who's just been married, and her husband move into the home. Francis lives out the remainder of his days in the townhouse directly next door. He's retired from business. He's still an active member in the Presbyterian Church, but he's just sort of lost that zest for life and business. He dotes on his children. He spends a lot of time sort of reminiscing about days gone past. And he actually, he sort of fades away in May of 1870. He actually passes away surrounded by family 3 days after suffering from a stroke. And Francis Sorrell's story essentially comes to an end directly next door. So that's what follows the Sorrell story.
Crazy stuff. All right. That leads you through the tragedies and the horrific history of Sorrell Weed House. We'll find out if there was any more that occurred after the well-known deaths, and we'll find out about the haunting, the subsequent haunting that's taken place there for many years. We'll be back with more of the best in paranormal talk radio right after this.
Beyond the darkness.
Welcome back to Beyond the Darkness. You like that creepy voice, Tim?
Yeah, it's kind of creepy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like the Barry White of Transylvania. Hey, baby, I want to drink your blood. We're here tonight talking about the haunted history of the Sorrell Weed House of Savannah, Georgia. Our guest this evening, Nick Wood, he's here with us. He's the official storyteller, Tim. He is a historian and storyteller who works with it. As a matter of fact, you spend so much time there, your coworkers think maybe you're a ghost.
No, yeah, it's true. I actually do spend a lot of time here at the property. You'll find me here at least 6 nights a week, day and night. There's a lot of upkeep that comes to a historic landmark and a mansion like Sorrell Weed. And aside from the paranormal activity that we experience here, you know, we're a historic landmark. We give guided tours discussing our history and our incredible architecture. And so this place is sort of volunteer run.
Right.
In the sense that, you know, myself and the daytime manager, Calvin, we're the ones on the roof patching a leaky hole. We're the ones tending to the garden. We're the ones, you know, fixing the plaster or
there
moving
you go.
The furniture about.
See, Tim, just pull your double wide to Savannah, Georgia.
Oh.
Plant it in the park across the street from Sorrel Weed and tell Nick and his buddies that it's haunted and they'll do all your upkeep for you for free.
Nice. Yeah.
They're good people in Savannah.
I guess.
Not bright, but they're good people, Tim.
All right.
Nick, I would like you to try an experiment there. Because you spend so much time there and you have such passion for the place, I want you to try to ghost hunt yourself. Now, I know that sounds weird, but hear me out. If time is not really linear and it's a wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey mess, right? And it's all happening simultaneously. You're there all the time. You've got to be creating your own residual haunting because of the energy you expend there and the time that you spend there and the passion you show for it. It would be interesting to see if you could contact a future version of yourself in that house while investigating. Has something like that ever happened? Have you ever caught an EVP of your own voice coming back at you?
Insanely deep. My goodness. Okay, so if that were the case,
when we talk weed houses, I get real deep, son, real deep.
I would have to say, this very thing sort of popped up last night in a guest experience where we had, we operate 3 nights a week. We do a paranormal investigation that is open to the public, and it's very limited numbers of the public.
Okay.
And they come in here and they try to capture EVPs, make contact, interact with the spirits, capture evidence. It's as authentic as we can make it to our own investigating. I belong to a paranormal investigative group. We research, we conduct scientific experiments. We try to make it as authentic as we can. We've got guests who spent a Friday night here investigating until 2:30 in the morning, had an incredible paranormal experience, went to another location here in Savannah to do an investigation that was sort of on the touristy side. And they sent us a text message about midnight last night saying, "We're over here and we just captured an EVP of them asking for Nick and Gordon." This is a place that isn't associated with the Sorrel Weed House.
Right.
Apparently, the ghosts a few blocks over are asking us to come and spend some time with them.
Or maybe the ghosts of your place accidentally went with the people that left and now they were stranded and needed a ride back.
If that had been the case, Dave, it probably would have been a little bit more vulgar, I'll be honest.
Oh, really? You have vulgar spirits there?
Something like poop or something like that. It would have been silly.
You know, the reason I ask, Nick, when I did an investigation at Sorrel Weed House, it's got to be 8 years ago.
Yeah.
I was in the basement with a group of about five people. We were standing in a circle down by, and it's been a long time, but there's like that kind of bar area. Do you know what I'm talking about?
There was a bar area,
right.
But I know the area you're talking about.
We were standing there all in a circle, and we could all see each other, and I asked a few questions, and I said, "Did you work here? Did you live here?" Whatever. And when I asked if you worked here, when we played it back, it is the loudest, clearest EVP I've ever heard, and it's my voice. And everybody was like, "What the hell?" Because when I played it back, I'm holding it up to my ear because I'm trying not to interrupt the hunt. And they're all standing kind of looking around in the dark. And you hear me go, "Did you work here?" "Yes." And it's my voice groaning it out. There's no doubt when you hear it, it's my voice. And when we went back and played it for the event coordinator, he's like, "Dude, that's your voice. Stop joking around." I said, "Exactly." We were all standing there. I didn't speak. I didn't whisper. We were tagging every other noise in this. And I certainly wouldn't be the one to respond to the EVP while we're all standing there facing each other. You'd know this. So I got to really, that was one of the creepier moments, even though it wasn't anything like, "I'm going to kill you, Dave," or "get out." It was just, "Yes." But that it was using my own voice back was what was so disturbing.
It almost makes me wonder if maybe some of the spirits that are residing here in Sorrel Weed Mansion might not have a bit of a sense of humor, and maybe they're playing tricks and just being a really good impressionist. I wouldn't put it past. I think this always being a party house, I like to think that some of the activity we're experiencing is residual from those parties.
Right.
But I also think that, I mean, there are playful things that'll occur here. I have never heard an EVP that sounded like myself or any of the staff, but some of the EVPs that we've captured, we can listen to an EVP that was captured upstairs in one of the, like the gentleman's parlor. And then what's interesting is we'll catch an EVP down in the lower level of the house beneath the parlors, and it'll be almost the same voice, almost as if that whoever was interacting with us upstairs has followed us downstairs, and we're getting answers from them down below. Amazingly, I found that a lot of EVPs are that way. We're actually – voices seem very, very similar or familiar in different parts of the house, which sort of confirms the intelligent level of paranormal activity
right.
taking place on the property. But that's not to say we're not also – and historically speaking, we've sort of always experienced the residual paranormal activity,
yeah.
the thing that sort of replays itself. But when I hear about guests getting their earrings tugged on and played with, when I hear about children interacting with other unseen children just playing in the lower levels of the house, I mean, that sort of confirms the intelligent hauntings.
That talking about the residual aspect, the owner was there that night and he stayed upstairs in his room and was kind of out of everybody's way, and it was winding down at the end of the night, and there were three of us. We were sitting in that sitting room on the main floor, that living room area by a fireplace. And again, it's been 8 years, so I'm trying to remember the layout of this house, but I remember sitting in that room. Everybody's exhausted. It's late at night. We've had a long day. We've had a long 4-hour investigation. And we're all just kind of sitting there running recorders. Nobody's talking. Nobody's doing anything. And the owner came down and was asking what all that racket was. And we're like, what racket? And he said, oh, it sounded like you guys were having a damn party down here. And we all kind of laughed. We go, no, we're too exhausted to move. And we played back the recording, and I'll be damned if you couldn't hear. And even the owner just kind of shook his head and laughed and went back upstairs. You hear just the sound of us sitting in this room, but around us, you're hearing footsteps. You're hearing clink, 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 glasses clinking. In the background, there's almost like music. It was really very surreal and strange. And he was kind of picking up on it upstairs in his room. And we're like in the middle of Party Central, and we capture this EVP with this muted party going on around us.
I am so glad that you actually mentioned that. I mean, I can't tell you how glad I am you mentioned that, because night after night, when I'm sharing stories inside the mansion, and I'm presenting paranormal evidence to my guests, being a storyteller, I'm trying to paint a picture using just words. And one of the stories that I'll go into detail of is that truly from 1838 right up until that tragic night, this was a party house. And my proof of that is, and the reason I talk about it, and I tell people this is the reason I'm talking about this, is those that reside in this house, whether they be the owner or former owner or the caretaker or one of us is staying there for the night, we don't just hear voices, we can hear entire conversations echoing from those rooms like there's a party going on. We can hear music in the distance. We can hear crystal being chimed on.
Right.
You had mentioned you hear the clink, clink, clink. We hear crystal being chimed on, followed by laughter. It's our strong belief, I mean, we sincerely believe this wholeheartedly, those parties left a very strong impression. And a residual haunting doesn't necessarily mean that a tragic occurrence took place. It could be a triumphant occurrence. Think of what they call the battlefield haunting. Here, a big tragedy took place. A lot of men lost their lives. A war, blood was spilled. But also in Savannah, Savannah's the hostess city of the South. We hosted the British during the Revolutionary War. We entertained them like they were our guests. That's just Savannah. We entertained the Union.
That's taking Southern politeness a little too far.
Okay, well, but this has always been a party place, and I strongly believe that those wonderful times that were had, not just the tragedies that took place here, but I strongly believe that those more positive times left an impression upon the mansion that even today, this is a party house. I frequently joke with guests saying that we've got to stop leaving the back doors open in the evening time because I think more ghosts just keep trickling in. I think they go, oh, there's a party going on at 6 West Terrace. Let's go.
I'm Tom Boudette. We'll leave the light on for you. Yeah, it seems like, well, you've got to guess, though, if there's all that energy and all that interest in communicating there, and you've got all these spirits of Savannah, why wouldn't they come to the place that's most hopping with the dead and living?
Exactly. Sort of think of Walt Disney's Haunted Mansion. You know, it's the house of 999 spirits, and they're all having a very wonderful time. But to say that, Dave, also leads me into things like what we're experiencing in the lower levels of the house, the basement, the working areas of the house, the slave areas of the house, the carriage house, and Molly's room. Not everything that we're experiencing here is of a happier time. And I mean, even when you were speaking with the Ghost Brothers, you touched on a topic that is actually very, very important to us. And they spoke about it in some depth about experiencing paranormal activity attributed to slavery and the urban slave lifestyle and the tragedies and sort of, unfortunately, they're blights on history, they're blights on our past. But if we don't think about those uglier parts of the antebellum South, we lose touch with our history. And some of the things that we're experiencing in this house don't depict a happy time. And I'd like to actually talk a little bit about that.
Nope, sorry, we're all out of time. Nick, have a great night. No, yeah, please, that's why you're here. Tell us about that. What would you like to share from those parts of the history and haunting?
Well, I mean, it's widely known. A lot of folks that know the Sorrel Weed name know the folklore. They know the legend of Molly and Matilda and slavery. And I can't tell you how many times, not even during an actual investigation, just visitors to this property are overwhelmed with emotion when they approach areas like our slave quarters, Molly's room, the kitchens. It's a step aside from the rural slave environment that so many people picture in their mind when they hear the word slavery or slavery in America. And people are overwhelmed with sadness, with grief, and they don't understand why. And a lot of this is experienced even during the day when we're just simply talking about history and architecture. And then, I mean, we sort of shy away from talking about the paranormal during the daylight hours. But people don't understand why. And then we sort of, you know, hint around about the tragedies and the ghostly activity, and it hits people very, very hard. They feel overwhelming sadness in Molly's room. They feel this sense of loss and fear. And some of the things that we experience in an EVP sessions and things like that just harken back to a sadder part of this property's history.
Do you get recordings of that that let you in on that aspect of the history?
We do. We do in a sense. In the slave quarter specifically, conducting paranormal investigations outside of the public view, most of us here that are here associated with the ghost tours and things like that, we genuinely have an interest in the science behind paranormal activity. And we'll do research, we'll use trigger objects, we'll try to conduct EVP sessions. Some of the things that we're picking up on in the slave quarters is that it's not just a female spirit in Molly's room. We're picking up on at least three male entities that you could sort of categorize as one is an older gentleman who is who's not fond of our poking and prying in our electronic devices. There is another dominating male spirit who seems to be a little protective of that area. And then there's another male spirit that we've interacted with upstairs in the slave quarters that is best described as a young man. And we've in all of our EVP sessions and all of our sessions up there, he doesn't respond or he doesn't like being called a young boy or a child or a little boy. He really responds through EVPs and through interactions with devices like REM pods and K2 meters. He really responds to being called a young man. And I genuinely believe that these are spirits associated with the slaves that were on this property in the pre-1860s.
Tell me about some – I know you sent me some photographs that I got today. Talk to me about some of the weirder experiences and ghostly apparitions, sightings, and evidence that you guys have captured there.
So I sent something to you, yes, this afternoon that I was – I've been very, very excited about, but we've been very hesitant to share with the public, although – I want to say that what you're looking at, we are actually going to make available to the public to see. We've been studying these images for more than a month now, and we've had an awful lot of eyes on them. Something that our guest captured. Now, in the lower levels of the house, when I say the lower levels, that's where the kitchens are. That's where the linen room was. That was the bustling epicenter of the house in the antebellum day. That was where all the slaves performed all their daily chores and activities. There is what we call hot spots. And Dave, you're aware of this. Hot spots, those areas where we regularly experience heightened activity. Frank's room, which used to be a medical surgery, there's a lot of pinches and pokes and ladies' dangly earrings getting played with. But in this one particular room adjacent to that, what we call a linen room, a room that we wouldn't necessarily attribute paranormal activity to, about a month ago, a guest captured something during one of my tours. Now, to set the scene for you, I have 33 guests. It was a busy night, far more guests than I'd like to have it crammed in together. But 33 guests are standing in Frank's surgery room. I open up a pair of double doors that lead to the linen room. A gentleman is standing directly beside me. The linen room is completely empty. There's an oil lamp on a working table. And over in the corner to the right is a doorway draped with a black sheet. He takes a photo looking into this room. His camera pops up with the image that he just took. And standing in the doorway to the right is a figure. And not just a shadowy figure, a woman. Plain as day, you can see this. There's a figure standing in this doorway, and she appears to be gazing out of the front window. He is immediately taken aback when he sees the photo he's just taken. We walk into that room. 33 guests will all attest that when that photo was taken, the room was completely void of anybody. There was no physical being in that room. Yet in this photograph, we have a woman standing in this doorway. Now, this is something that it's not common, but it is captured frequently. We have guests that capture full-bodied apparitions standing in the parlors, in the hallways, and they've shown up. And we see these ghastly figures standing in a room just as the room is today, as if this spirit is visiting us in the now. All right. But this image that this gentleman captures, it's not just of a full-bodied apparition. What is absolutely boggling our minds is the fact that when this image was taken, this apparition is standing in a doorway. And we're seeing that doorway as it was a century and a half ago, not as we're seeing that doorway today. So what we have today is that doorway has a doorway, a wood door and a wood frame, and there's a black privacy curtain hanging in front of that doorway. That room is now a closet. Originally, it was a breezeway. It led from a hallway to the linen room. It was a corridor used by the slaves. in this photo, we're not seeing a black curtain. We're not seeing a wood doorway. We're seeing a brick entrance the way it is, as if you had taken the curtain away, taken the door frame away, taken the door away, and there she is standing in a different time.
That's astounding.
It was. Exactly. We have all these examples of apparitions being captured in the now. In all my years here at the property, this is the first time I've ever seen a piece of evidence where we're seeing then. We're seeing back in time. And so this took a lot of work to try to debunk, to study, to try to wrap our heads around. We took the curtain down. We took the door off the frames. We photographed this angle hundreds of times and then did an overlay. And Dave, what is really getting us? What's really making us excited right now, this time in our history, is that when we overlay today's picture with the door removed, we're seeing the brick and the mortar on the other side of that doorway lining up with that photo of that apparition.
Wow. How do you even begin to explain that? I mean, then you are looking through the veil of time and space.
Exactly. And as much experience as we have studying paranormal activity, visiting active locations, conducting research, doing sessions, doing your good old-fashioned, what they generically call ghost hunting, in everything that we've ever come across, this is a first for us. And to try to understand it and to try to explain it is something that we're struggling with. And I want to show this to the public, and we're going to make this image available to the public to see. But before we put it out there, we wanted to try to debunk it every which way we could.
Mm-hmm.
And the more we tried, just the more difficult it became to understand without tapping into the theories of time and space and portals and
parallel universes, slips, right? Yeah.
Things that are maybe a little bit beyond my personal abilities and knowledge. Let's put it that way.
Where are you going to post these pictures?
Okay, so first of all, I wanna go ahead and offer it up to you and say, hey, you can go ahead and share it if you'd like. We're actually going to make these images available on the Sorrel Weed House website, which is sorrelweedhouse.com. There's an evidence page where our guests can go and look at pieces of evidence captured by other guests. And it's a lot of great fun. People get to go back and look at some of the evidence, listen to videos, watch videos, listen to audio. But we're going to make it available there, but we're also going to it's going to be accompanied by an article just sort of explaining how it was captured, what we did once we received this piece of evidence, how we went about trying to debunk it, trying to understand it. We're going to try to explain the best we can our methods once we saw this piece of evidence. And when I say when we saw this piece of evidence, I was there when the photo was captured. I was standing directly next to the man who photographed it. My jaw was on the floor. His jaw was on the floor. And needless to say, the tour pretty much ground to a halt right there because people were pretty much just overwhelmed with this being captured right then and there.
That is astounding. And you're going to put it up at SorrelWeedHouse.com?
Yeah, on the guests would just click on the evidence page and they'll find it right there at the top.
How soon will you have that up and posted?
I'll probably have that up by right now when everyone's listening to this.
Great. Fantastic. Look at that, guys. We've traveled through space and time to make these pictures available to you. And instead of us posting them, I want you just to go check out the SorrelWeedHouse.com website and see it for yourself. We may post one picture just to give people a little tease on our site, but we'll on our social media when we post about the show here. But please go check out SorrelWeedHouse.com. Were there any other deaths that took place in that house after the tragedies that befell Molly and Matilda?
There were. I mean, there are documented, and then there are those that are written about and accounted for, but necessarily weren't published. Of course, the Sorrells lost, Matilda Sorrell lost three young children to childhood diseases inside the house during their time. During outbreaks of yellow fever, though Dr. Frank Sorrell, who actually had a medical practice in the basement of his father's house, didn't practice general medicine, he did from time treat people with yellow fever and actually had converted part of the breezeway into what you'd call recovery rooms. And so there are we know that one young slave, a young boy, approximately the age of 10, falls off the tax records, falls off the census around the age of 10. And there are hints in documents that lead us to believe that he may have been injured on the property and succumbed to his injuries. I'm sure that over the years, the following families, you know, people didn't go to a hospital or a hospice to expire. You know, you stayed at home. I'm sure there are other deaths that perhaps aren't front and center like Matilda Sorrell's death is. But also you have to think about before this was a house. The British soldiers that were trapped beneath the rubble of British barracks destroyed during the war. Other things that could have transpired. The activity that we're experiencing isn't just surrounding the Sorrells. It's surrounding, you know, we've got soldiers, we've got both Revolutionary era and Civil War era soldiers that have been spotted and captured in photos on the property. So when I think about other deaths, you know, documented, there's the children and maybe a handful of patients that belong to Frank Sorrell. But of course, Matilda and Molly are front and center.
Well, Nicholas, if people want to come and hear you tell the tales and lead the ghost hunts, how do they find out more information?
Well, they'd visit us at SorrellWeedHouse.com, or they can visit myself at SavannahStoryteller.com. I present an in-depth tour every Friday and Saturday night to a limited audience, and tickets can be purchased, of course, online or by calling the museum here in Savannah. But, I mean, as you can tell, I'm very enthusiastic about sharing these stories. And I love sharing these stories with guests. So I hope folks will come and visit us and possibly have an experience, a paranormal experience of their own.
Cool. Do you have a quick creepy story to lead us out with?
Yeah, I will tell you that about a year ago, well, I guess last spring, the caretaker that lives here has a dog that lives up on the third floor and is, I want to say, pretty acclimated to paranormal activity. Not much phases him. One night, he's going berserk out on the third floor balcony, actually right around the area where Matilda jumped from. And to get a better view of what was going on up there, I actually went into the carriage house, went upstairs to look across the courtyard to the third floor to see why this dog was going berserk. And I couldn't quite figure out why, but out the corner of my eye, I see a figure standing in the doorway of Molly's room. And it's a very tall figure. I looked over and I thought, well, a tour is getting ready to start. It's pretty common for guests to kind of sneak in here and go upstairs. I thought a guest was just up in Molly's room. And I started yelling at him, hey, you got to come out of there. You got to come out. You can't be up here right now. And it sort of shifted to one side. And I said, I can see you. Come on out of there. And it did. It came out of the doorway. First of all, this shadow figure is as tall as the doorway. It almost looks as if it ducks to come through the doorway and starts crossing the room at what I can only describe as a fast pace. And it is approaching me very quickly. And with as much as I've experienced here, this frightened me, and I turned tail and raced down the staircase out of the carriage house. And for the next 10 minutes, I couldn't even speak. I was so shocked, frightened, scared, because this was the first time anything had ever charged at me. And so I got to say that that's probably one of my scariest experiences at the Sorrell Weed House.
SavannahStoryteller.com and SorrellWeedhouse.com. Check out those sites for more information on historic Savannah, Georgia's most haunted location. That's it for this evening. Remember, if you want to see Tim Dennis this weekend, Tim, tell them how they can do it.
Very simply, MoundsTheater.org is where you go to get your tickets. IWI returns to the Mounds Theater in lovely St. Paul, Minnesota. For Night of the Luchas, we're celebrating Cinco de Mayo weekend by an all Lucha Libre card, Dave.
Will there be beer? Cervezas?
There's cervezas. There's
margaritas?
No margaritas, though, Dave. Yeah.
Will there be thrown punches?
Yeah, we're throwing punches.
Will there be flying Latino wrestlers?
Yes.
I'm in.
Yeah.
That sounds cool.
Yeah.
And it is. It's a fun, it's a totally different kind of environment, and it's full of energy. So come on out and check it out.
Family friendly as well.
Yes.
So we've got, we'll have everything you can imagine as far as concessions goes, and lots of great fun. 6:45 is when doors open. 7:30 is bell time there at the Mounds Theater on Saturday, May 6th. We're celebrating Cinco de Mayo weekend. Again, discount general admission tickets, VIP tickets available at MoundsTheater.org.
Fantastic. And you can find me at Wizard World Minneapolis this weekend. I'll be there Friday with two presentations on superhero movies and the paranormal. Saturday, I'll be there doing the Doctor Whoniverse fan panel. And Sunday, I'll be monkeying around with Peter Tork and Mickey Dolenz. You can find more information about that by checking out Wizard World Minneapolis online to get your tickets and be a part of it. If you missed out on True Crime Tuesday this week, you can still go get the episodes. As a matter of fact, you can subscribe and never miss another minute in the best of true crime talk radio. Bloodthirst, the true story of Wayne Bodden, the vampire rapist and killer. You'll be able to check that out for yourself. Alan Warren, it was a fascinating story. Plus, oh, Florida Man was at it again, Tim.
Oh,
lots
yeah.
of dumb crimes and stupid criminals. To get subscribed, just go check out darknessradio.com. darknessradio.com. Click on the True Crime Tuesday tab. There you'll see the little banner. Click on it. It'll take you in and show you all you need to know. It's only $5 a month, $1.25 an episode for 90 minutes to 2 hours every Tuesday delivered to you when you subscribe. So make sure you check that out. And we've got some good news for you, the listeners that are always wanting more Beyond the Darkness and Darkness Radio. For the first time, we are going to start making our archived shows available from the first year, 2006. We have come into conjunction with Conflict, is the name of the organization on YouTube. They're going to have three episodes, classic episodes, every week of your favorite. And you guys will get to go way back and hear some of our very first attempts at paranormal talk radio.
Uh-huh.
And did you actually give them the Jason Hawes episode?
Yeah, they do have it. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
They get the very first. You guys get to hear the very first episode from January 1st, 2006, when we talked to and talking about Nacho Libre.
Yeah.
We've got Mexican music coming through the board during half the show. So poor Jason Hawes couldn't even hear us because of the Mexican music. We couldn't figure out what was going on with the systems. It was fun, creepy, fun, weird. But we've got three brand new episodes of our old archives available. And the best way to find it is go to darknessradio.com. And you'll see our YouTube page banner. And we're going to also include that on our Darkness Radio application as well, if you've got that, so that you can find it easier. But three new episodes will be up every week, so you can extend your listening pleasure and check out all the old episodes from back in 2006 as we slowly release them three episodes a week until we make our way through all of our dark hives. Tim, doesn't that sound exciting?
It is exciting.
Pretty cool. And also want you guys to join us. There's only a few slots that remain. Come on out to London with me. London's calling this August, and we want you to be a part of our first wave British invasion as we go investigate the haunt of historic England. And it's going to be amazing. Neil Story is our tour guide. You've heard him on our show. You've heard him on Darkness Radio. You've heard him on Coast to Coast AM. We'd love for you to come out and be a part of this with us as we get to tour and see some of the most haunted and historic sites in England, including Stonehenge, Tim. We get to investigate Rising Castle. We get to investigate the Derby Jail. We get to visit some of the most remarkable places, and we follow in the footsteps of Jack the Ripper and Bram Stoker's Dracula. It is going to be the adventure of a lifetime. There are still some availability, so you can check that out at darknessevents.com. Darknessevents.com is the way to keep up with that. And remember, I'll be hosting Coast to Coast AM again at the end of May. We'll be doing the last Friday and Saturday, Tim, of Coast to Coast AM. And if you're not familiar with it, it's the best in overnight talk radio. Heard on over 600 stations nationwide, millions of listeners around the world. Tonight, our good friend George Norrie will be talking alternative health tips. If you're looking for answers to feeling better and common medicine is not working, then check out this show. You're going to definitely want to hear it. Benjamin Fuchs is the guest. And then reptilian gods, Jeffrey Daughtry, will be joining George Norrie in the second half of tonight's show. We'll be back tomorrow as we look at UFOs, monsters, and strange anomalies with Butch Witkowski. We want to thank BarkBox, our sponsor this evening. Remember, go sign up, get that free extra month of BarkBox. Visit getbarkbox.com/darkness when you subscribe for an additional month. They have 1, 6, and 12-month subscriptions, so you can get the perfect treats and toys for your furry friends. Go check it out, and you can cancel anytime. And we also want to thank Amazon.com. Remember, when you're going to make your purchases, visit darknessradio.com, click on that killer deals link, and you get more information on how you can order through those buttons, and a small portion of each show goes out to help your buddies here on Beyond the Darkness.